up with Jesus speaking to the religious leaders in the temple complex area. It's translated in the temple, but not always meaning the actual building of the temple, but in that complex. You know, it was surrounded by, you know, a lot of acres of just courtyard. And that's where Jesus was. But probably still on the same day. It is, it's either Tuesday or Wednesday, most likely. It's really hard to nail down specifically which day it is, but it's one of those two, undoubtedly. Now, I want you to notice, remember what I just said about in chapter 22, he's speaking primarily to the religious leaders, the Sadducees, Pharisees, the scribes, the lawyers, or the experts in the Jewish law. I want you to notice in the first part of this one, he is going to be speaking to other people. He's not directing his comments yet directly to the religious leadership. He's going to get back to that, but he's going to be speaking more about them than to them. And then a little bit later, he's going to be speaking more directly to them in what is called the seven woes. Then, verse 1, then Jesus spoke to the crowds and to his disciples. You see now the focus, he's speaking to his disciples and the crowds of people that are there listening. And he says, the scribes and the Pharisees are seated in the chair of Moses. Therefore, do whatever they tell you and observe it, but don't do what they do, because they don't practice what they teach. They tie up heavy loads that are hard to carry and put them on people's shoulders, but they themselves aren't willing to lift a finger to move them. They do everything to be observed by others. They enlarge their phylacteries. They lengthen their tassels. They love the place of honor at banquets and the front seats or the best seats in the synagogues, greetings in the marketplace, and to be called rabbi by people. Now, the religious leaders are there. They are still listening. And this chapter, Jesus pulls no punches, or withholds no punches. Is what I mean to say. He does not hold anything back. He goes directly for the religious jugular of these individuals, these religious leaders. I came across something when preparing for tonight that I was totally unaware of. There's a group of writings, basically it's oral tradition. It's called the Mishnah. It's Jewish in its origin. It's not in the Old Testament, but it's oral traditions coming from it. And I was surprised to discover that even in this particular edition of the Mishnah, there was an indictment against the Pharisees. There's seven different groups of Pharisees, or kinds of Pharisees, I guess denominations of Pharisees, that were talked about, and only one favorably. I want you to listen to this. Jesus extricates the Pharisees in Matthew chapter 23, but he's not alone in doing so. Others within Judaism were critical of Pharisaism. For example, in Mishnah Sota 22b, seven different kinds of Pharisees are discussed, six of which are portrayed negatively. They are. Anyway, you can understand why Jesus said they wanted to be noticed for their righteousness. There was the shoulder Pharisees that wore good deeds on his shoulder so everyone could see them. Get the idea of actually writing it on his shoulder so people could read his good deeds, what he's been doing. The second group is the wait a little Pharisee that was always found an excuse for putting off good works. He's the one, you know, has the round to it. When I get around to it, you know, that he'll do it. Here, this is maybe the funniest ones, I guess. I don't know. It says, the bruised Pharisee. He would shut his eyes to avoid seeing women and would knock himself into walls. close his eyes and walk into something. So I guess they had bruises upon them, but he didn't want to run the risk of lusting, I guess. And then there was the humpback Pharisee that always walked bent over in false humility. There was the ever-reckoning Pharisee that was always counting up the numbers of his good deeds. There was the fearful Pharisee, always quaked in fear of the wrath of God. And there was here's the only one that actually received any kind of positive thought. There was the God-loving Pharisee, who was a copy of Abraham, who lived in faith and charity. What Jesus does here is akin to the other in-house criticisms of some of the Jewish people of other Jewish people. So it's quite interesting, I think, to some degree, that there were those different categories, I guess, or practices of some of those Pharisees. Jesus is going to be a little bit sterner. He's really not differentiating that much. It is interesting to note there were Pharisees that were open and some very positive to Jesus. That may be surprising, because normally we think of the word Pharisee, we think of them they were the antagonists. They were always against Jesus. They were always causing problems and trying to get him to trip himself up and even seeking his demise. There were probably the majority did do that, but there are some that did not. There are some did not, especially post-resurrection, after the resurrection. There were a lot of priests and Pharisees that came to faith. You might even know of one by the name of Paul. And of course, you also, in John's Gospel, you meet a couple of other favorable Pharisees. Anybody know who they were? Nicodemus is one. Joseph of Arimathea is the other. Yes. Very good. So, Jesus points that out. And then in verses 8 through 12, it's caused a lot of people confusion. Me being one. At least at one time. But as for you, now who's he speaking to? Who's the you? Disciples? Yeah. And then the crowds. Okay? As for you, do not be called rabbi, because you have one teacher, and you are all brothers. Do not call anyone on earth father, for you have one Father who's in heaven. Do not be called masters or teacher, or it could be sometimes, I think the New American Standard renders that, instructors. Because you have one master, and that is the Messiah or the Christ. The greatest among you will be your servant. Whoever exalts himself will be humbled, and whoever humbles himself will be exalted. So, some have argued, well, it says right there, call no man father. It also says to go call any man teacher. And what he's saying, I believe, is he's pointing out the titles that the Pharisees loved to have. Said about them. They insisted upon it. And in doing so, it was a way of receiving prestige, or at least they thought so, by requiring people to call them rabbi, or even one that might even have even a higher rank among the rabbis, call him father, indicating the exalted position that he had. They always said, Jesus had already mentioned that they liked those places of honor in the synagogues. They liked to be greeted in the marketplace by those honorific titles. And Jesus is telling them, by what he concludes is, don't do that. Don't do that. Don't be striving for positions of higher than others. Because in God's economy or in God's kingdom, it's the humble that are highly esteemed. And those that are prideful, they're the ones that are going to be humbled. It's that great reversal that we've looked at before, that Jesus talks about. And here it is, it's mentioned once again. And he also makes mention just prior to this about how they would show themselves in public. Phylacteries. You may know what a phylactery is. You may have seen pictures of them. If you ever have the opportunity or look at pictures of the Wailing Wall, it's easy to pick out the phylacteries. They come in two forms. One is they will be on the forehead. It's a little leather box or pouch that will be on their forehead. Or it will be on their arm, and there's a leather strap you'll find wrapped around their arm, and then they'll be holding the phylactery. And that was just a sign of reverence. But see, they made their phylacteries bigger, so you can see them easier, right? You don't miss it. And then on the robes, there were these strands of string. Usually they were blue. And they were just reminders of the people to keep the law. Well, they weren't satisfied with just the ones that they would normally, that most people would normally wear. They would really stand out. So they made those larger, so they'd be easier seen. You're getting the point, right? So Jesus is talking about this religious arrogance that these religious leaders were experiencing. It's kind of a joke when I was in seminary. If you want to find out whether your professor is actually a humble man or not, just call him Mister. See what happens. See if he corrects you or not. Oh no, doctor. You know, and it's kind of funny thing. I don't know many more about it than that, but some would. Some really would. They'd correct you right quickly, you know. I used to listen to a fellow on the radio. He's retired now. And in his pastoral prayer, he prayed just prior to his preaching. He would talk about himself in the third person. He said they call him Reverend, but he's not. So that was pretty cool, I thought. You know, get those honorific kind of titles. Don't be consumed by those. Anyway, Jesus is pointing that out. And it's important. Hey, don't get hung up on that kind of thing. And you will be corrected by some. And it's amazing to me. Of course, Southern Baptist, local church autonomy, we are in friendly cooperation, but we are not a denomination that has a hierarchy, regardless of what sometimes the people that we think that are in leadership, that think there's a hierarchy, there's not. But it's amazing in some denominations or structure, there is a hierarchy. Even if you know, the Bible speaks against it. They have it. And there are some that would probably even lack it in Southern Baptist life, but that's not our church polity. We don't do that way. We've talked about that before. Now, in verse 13, we begin with the woes. There are seven. But in the translation I'm using, you will see there's going to be eight. Because there's one verse that's kind of in question, and that verse is verse 14. Even though it doesn't appear in the oldest manuscript of Matthew, I think it fits. And it sounds to me like it's something that Jesus would have said. And not only that, he does say it in both Mark and in Luke. So, do that with what you want, but we'll get with the woes. Now the woes are kind of like a groan. Like, oh. And then it's almost a statement of grief that they're this way. Kind of like it's painful to point out that it's this way. So it's even the word, and I don't remember the pronunciation of the Greek word, but the word almost sounds like a groanish kind of sounding word. I don't know if you've ever seen this or not, but a number of years ago, there was the Gospel of Matthew that was done in what was called the Visual Bible. And it was the Gospel of Matthew, word for word. And it was actors in it. And the individual that played the role of Jesus, his name was Bruce Marciano. And there's at least there used to be something in the library. I don't know if it still is or not. I think it was VHS format, so it may not be in there anymore. But you can watch it on YouTube. It might be broken up, but you can watch it on YouTube. Anyway, Bruce Marciano did a very good job portraying, I think, the Lord in his methodology of doing that. He based it on Hebrews chapter 12, verse 2. For the joy that was set before him, he endured the cross, despising his shame, is now seated at the right hand of God. So he actually was a happy Jesus. Do you remember the greatest story ever told? Or Jesus of Nazareth? Both of those, you have a very somber Jesus. He's been, drinking persimmon juice or something. Just kind of sour. But Marciano does a good job. That's neither here nor there. But his take on chapter 23 of Matthew, because every red letter he memorized. And the black letter, there would either be someone else speaking or the narrator that was speaking. So every word from the Gospel of Matthew was used in that presentation. When he got to chapter 23, it took over 2 days for them to film that exchange. And the reason why is Marciano couldn't finish it. Because he immersed himself, of course, in the words of Jesus. And he said that he would just break down weeping before he could finish filming that. And they had to film it and take a break and then film more and take a break and then do all the splicing together and everything. And this is what he said about it. It was quite interesting, I thought. This is what he said it was like for him. He was trying to imagine what it would have been like for Jesus. But for him, this is how he saw it. So I'm not saying Jesus saw it this way, but this is what how he described it. He said, this is what I felt like. I felt like a father looking out of a window and seeing my toddler walking out into traffic. That's what it felt like, doing this. It was quite an interesting observation, because it sounds as if Jesus is furious. But all we're doing is reading the words. We're not hearing the words said. And that's one of the difficulties that we face sometimes, because we assume a certain tone or a certain kind of appearance in saying these words, when it could be quite different. Marciano may have been right, that Jesus, looking at these Pharisees, Sadducees, hypocrites, he didn't hate them. He loved them. His heart was breaking that they would not respond to him. They would not open their eyes to who he is. And so maybe there's something that Marciano's onto something there. I don't know. But now the woes. But woe to you, scribes, Pharisees, hypocrites. He's going to say that over and over. He's prefacing his remarks with that kind of statement. Notice what he calls them. He begins, woe. You guys are in trouble. You're in serious trouble. Who? Scribes, Pharisees. But he doesn't stop there. He calls them hypocrites. What's a hypocrite? You don't need the Greek language to understand what a hypocrite is. You know what it is. It's like an old hill preacher said, if you ain't who you is who you ain't. That's what you are. You're pretending to be something that you're not. That's a hypocrite. That's a hypocrite. When you pretend to be something that you're not. And he's going to call them that over and over. Now, can you understand that Jesus is not trying to win friends and influence people? He's speaking in the most heaviest terms, the most vivid terms, trying, or at least attempting, to get those religious opponents to stop and think. One way you can do that is get people mad. But you run the risk of them killing you if you do. And so you understand the cross is coming, and you understand why, as he's here, because they're not going to listen. They're not going to open their hearts at all. So he says, you lock up the kingdom of heaven from people, for you don't go in, and you don't allow those entering to go in. You're actually a roadblock to the kingdom. You're standing in the way of people who would otherwise get into the kingdom. But you are the hindrances. You're not going to go in, and you're going to make sure that nobody else goes in. And that sounds pretty serious, doesn't it? That kind of indictment against these Pharisees. And he said that you're in trouble, and you don't even realize it. Now, verse 14 may not be in some of your translations, but I think it fits. Woe to you, scribes, Pharisees, hypocrites! You devour widows' houses and make long prayers just for a show or pretense. This is why you will receive harsher judgment or punishment. The next woe, verse 15. Woe to you, scribes, Pharisees, hypocrites! You travel over land and sea to make one proselyte, one convert. And when he becomes one, you make him twice. It's my translation I'm reading here. It says, fit for hell as you are. But make him, literally, you make him twice the son of hell as you are. Ouch. A proselyte is a Gentile that fully adopts Judaism. They go the whole route. If they're male, they're circumcised. They're also plunged into the water to identify with the Jewish religion and begin to be observant of the Old Testament law. And saying here, you will travel all over the world, land and sea, to find just one. And you make him twice the son of hell or twice what you are. And he uses a very picturesque word. You probably know the word. It's called Gehenna, the Valley of Hinnom, just outside of Jerusalem. It's in Jerusalem city today, but at that time it was still outside of Jerusalem. It was a place of child sacrifice that eventually became, because it was such a horrid place, it finally became a place that could never be used again for any kind of religious observance of any sort because it made it into a garbage dump. That's where you took the refuse. That's where you took the dead animals. That's where you'd throw a dead body that had no one to care for it and no one to see to the proper burial. You would take those kind of things and you would put them there. So it was a horrible place. And it was a good picture for those that Jesus was speaking to understand what he was talking about when he said hell. Many times there would be fires there trying to burn what refuse that would burn. So it's always smoldering, burning, and you get the imagery there. And that's why in Mark's gospel, Jesus refers to it, quoting from a picture from Isaiah, where the worm does not die and the fire is not quenched. And for them to understand that language, they just looked outside at Jerusalem at that garbage dump and they saw it. That's what that's the word he used, the Gehenna, the Valley of Hinnom. And the worms, of course, you know what kind of worms. They weren't fishing worms. They weren't caterpillars. They were maggots. So you get the picture. For a Jewish mindset, that was absolutely horrid. Because that is nothing but the filth and uncleanness that a reputable Jew would avoid at all costs. That's what he tells them. That's what you are. Verse 16, woe to you, blind guides, who say, whoever takes an oath by the sanctuary or by the temple, it's the naos. It is not the temple complex. It's the inner sanctuary. It's a portion that the people could not go into. It's a portion of the temple that only certain priests could enter. Let's use the word sanctuary. Whenever you make an oath by the sanctuary, it means nothing. But whoever takes an oath by the gold of the sanctuary is bound by his oath. It's a way of, you know, you're gonna swear an oath. You know, cross my heart, hope to die, stick a needle in my eye, you know, that kind of thing. Or what we do, you know, people will say, I'll swear on a stack of Bibles. You ever hear me say stuff like that? Trying to bolster their claim that what they're telling you is the truth, which may or may not be the case. The Jews had a way of doing that. Oh, I swear by the sanctuary. I can wiggle out of that one. I'm not obligated to keep that promise. But if I say, by the gold of the sanctuary, I mean, I've got to do it. I'm bound by it. Blind fools, for which is greater, the gold or the sanctuary that sanctified the gold? Also, whoever takes an oath by the altar, it means nothing. But whoever takes an oath by the gift that is on the altar is bound by his oath. Blind people. You call them blind fools? No, I call them blind people. For which is greater, the gift on the altar or that which sanctifies the gift? Therefore, the one who takes an oath by the altar takes an oath by it and everything on it. And the one who takes an oath by the sanctuary takes an oath by it and by him who dwells in it. And the one who takes an oath by heaven takes an oath by God's throne and by him who sits on it. He earlier said to refrain from taking oaths. Let your yes be yes and your no be no. Anything beyond that is from the evil one. So be the kind of people, if you say, this is the truth, it's the truth. I will do that, and you do that. Be that kind of person. Don't try to bolster the credibility by swearing oaths and probably casually doing so. But you see how the Pharisees had kind of, they made a way, a kind of escape clause for them. And if you weren't listening very carefully, they might actually take you in. I didn't say by the gold in the sanctuary. I just said by the sanctuary. Therefore, I don't have to follow through with that. So Jesus indicted them for that. The next woe. Woe to you, scribes, Pharisees, hypocrites. You pay a tenth of a mint, dill, and cumin. Yet you have neglected the more important matters of the law, justice, mercy, and faith. These things you should have been done without neglecting the others. Blind guides, you strain out a gnat, yet swallow a camel. A gnat was unclean. You're not supposed to eat them. A camel was unclean. You're not supposed to eat one of those either. That's not kosher food. But he's talking about how they focus on the minute while missing the big picture. You strain out a gnat. You almost get the idea of, you know, sitting down, some of you got a cup of coffee. You know, we're going along here and there's a gnat getting too close to it and a little booger falls down in your to your coffee. You know, it's just a gnat. It's no big deal. You're not going to die. So you just stick your finger down there or you get a piece of Kleenex or something and dip the little booger out, right? And so, you know, you're just straining at a gnat. You know, you strain it out. But then you swallow a camel, which is far, far greater. That's what they were doing. That's what they're doing with all their little rules and regulations. Remember, they had what was called the hedge about the law. It was an oral tradition, but it ended up with 613 different laws around the Ten Commandments because they believed that if you obey their commandments that enabled you to keep the commandments, you'd do a better job. I mean, you know, some of these poor people, they couldn't figure out what violating the Sabbath was, so they have a whole list of Sabbath rules you had to obey. It simply was not remember the Sabbath day to keep a whole system of things. And some of them were quite, you might think, bizarre. Today, if you go to Israel, you need to, now the to say Sabbath, it is, they call it, they pronounce it Sabbat. So the Sabbat. There, you do not, if you're staying in a building or a hotel with multiple floors, you do not want to ride on the Sabbat elevator. Every other day is fine. Get on, go to the top, push the top button, up you go. On the Sabbath, Saturday, that one elevator, and it's marked, you'll figure out which one it is, it's marked, it stops on every floor automatically. You don't touch any buttons. You know why you don't touch any buttons? Because it's considered work. How's it considered work? Well, it's considered building a fire. You mean what? Yeah, building the fire. See, because when you push the button, there's an electrical current that goes from that button to another area, you know, so you've got electric moving. So that's building a fire. So on the Sabbat elevator, you just get in and you get off on the floor that you're going to get off on, but you're going to have to go through, going to open up on every floor. That sounds wild, doesn't it? It's true. It's true. And on the Sabbath, you're not going to go to a local fast food joint because it's not open. It's not open. Now, if you're at a hotel, they'll have food for you. They probably hire Gentiles to cook it for you, but you will have food. Woe to you, scribes, Pharisees, hypocrites! You clean the outside of the cup and dish, but inside they are full of greed and self-indulgence. Blind Pharisee, first clean the inside of the cup so the outside of it may be clean also. Clean up your own act first. What, now, remember, what's he calling them? Over and over and over, hypocrites. You're pretending to be what you are not. The problem is you need to become what you're pretending to be. But you're not that, because you go through all these rituals, but inside is something far more filthy. Don't clean up just the outside. Do the inside as well. Let me pause for a moment. Any comments or questions that you'd like to offer?
I like that. That's an excuse a lot of people get not to come to church. Oh, I get my straightened down a little bit, or I get cleaned up, or I'll get better, or I'll come to church.
Don't realize there's nothing they can do to clean up anymore. Yeah, that's a common excuse because it's based on a misunderstanding. The misunderstanding is that when I do the proper work to make myself acceptable, then I'll come. And the problem is you'll never do that because you can't do that. As a matter of fact, the gospel excludes that as being any possibility at all. So you can see how these woes, because you know he's talking not only about those Pharisees, they're listening in. And he's indicting them, scribes, and he's calling them, you're fakes. You're simply a fake. One of the most disgusting experiences in God's sight is self-righteousness. We think it's other things. We think it's the Olympic Committee allowing that blasphemous representation of the Lord's Supper. That's bad. Yeah, sure. Don't think for a moment that that's the worst thing that God sees. We see it bad. And I understand. I'm not minimizing it at all. You know what's worse? A person that thinks, hey, I'm good. I don't need the blood of Christ. I'm good on my own. Or someone who's actually doing these religious things but is still trusting in his or her own goodness and the good things that they think that they're doing. And it may be good things. It's that self-righteous attitude. Because it's that self-righteous attitude that will never see a need for the gospel. I don't need it. I'm a good person. And that is the one thing that we must not ever think. I know what we mean sometimes when we say that we don't, you know, someone who's innocent maybe ended up in a tragedy. You know, how does an innocent person? But you need to realize there's no one innocent. No one. We're all messes. We all have our stuff, and none of us are acceptable before God, except for the imputed or the given righteousness of Jesus to us. If we receive Christ, we have His righteousness. He did what we could not do. And we need to always keep that in mind. Pharisees didn't get that. We're not done with the woes. We got more. Woe to you, scribes, Pharisees, hypocrites. You are like whitewashed tombs, which appear beautiful on the outside, but inside are full of dead men's bones and every impurity. In the same way, on the outside you seem righteous to people, but inside you are full of hypocrisy and lawlessness. Yeah, they're you can tell by smoke's coming from their ears right now because of what he's saying to them about them. Yeah, you think you've got it together. People think you've got it together, but you don't. And I know it. I know that you're just like a whitewashed grave. You see, again, the Jewish sensibilities, we don't share those, so we don't understand the fullness of what that means. What were they hearing? Well, what they were hearing was, okay, a whitewashed tomb. They understood what that meant, you know. You decorate it up, you know, paint it, whatever. But you didn't take care of the problem on the inside. And if you crawl in the inside, you're not fit to go to the temple. You're unclean. You're not fit to do a lot of different religious activities or exercise. You can't do that because you've been in a very contaminated place. That's what you are. And they're getting ticked. Here's the last woe. Woe to you, scribes, Pharisees, hypocrites. You build the tombs of the prophets and decorate the monuments of the righteous, and you say, if we had lived in the days of our fathers, we wouldn't have had taken part with them in the shedding of the prophets' blood. You therefore testify against yourselves that you are the sons of those who murdered the prophets. Fill up then the measure of your father's sins or unrighteousness. You may have said this at one time or another. I'm sure maybe most of us have. Oh, if I would have just lived in the days that Jesus was healing people and performing miracles, that would just, you know, how glorious and, you know, how much stronger my faith would, you know. No. You need to be careful about that. You need to be careful because there were people living then that saw all that and still rejected Jesus. The most glaring example of all is Judas. Judas. He saw it all. He heard it all. And yet, he was still the... He is still the child of the devil. It's just, you know, if we would have been there, we would have believed. I hope that's true, but you don't know that that's true. The Pharisees saw a lot of what Jesus did. They saw it. And yet many of those continue to reject. One of the most interesting passages is in John's Gospel. It's following chapter 11. Chapter 11, that's when Lazarus is raised from the dead. you read a little bit further and you know what you discover? That the Pharisees are aware, the religious leaders are aware that what had taken place, and now they're going to figure out, now we got to not only kill Jesus, we got to kill Lazarus. It didn't help them at all. So it's nice to say, oh, if I would have been there, it'd be so different. No. Jesus, that's what he's pointing out. No. No, it wouldn't have. It wouldn't have been different. So then he's going to compliment them. Snakes. Brood of vipers. How can you escape the condemnation of hell? It's kind of reminiscent of what John the Baptist said when the Pharisees came to check him out. Who warned, he called him a bunch of vipers. Who warned you to flee the coming judgment? And Jesus is calling them snakes. Very few people like snakes. Very few. They're just one of those kind of creatures that you know, I know there are people that have them in pets and that kind of thing. And I guess there's other kind of mental illnesses too. I'm kidding. I used to have some friends that they kept snakes and that kind of stuff. You know, they're kind of thing. And every time I went over to their house, I had to pull a snake out. I had a different attitude about snakes where I grew up. We wanted to move them all out of this world when we saw them. The venomous ones. If you ever saw a king snake, you didn't want to hurt them. You know, some people call them salt and pepper shed snakes. I don't know if you ever saw one. They have yellow and black all over them, you know. See, a king snake is immune to the venom of copperheads and rattlesnakes. And a king snake will kill them. It will kill poisonous snakes. Back in the hills where I grew up, it was not uncommon for people to find a king snake, catch it, take it home, let it loose into their house. Hey, the king snake is not going to hurt you, but it will kill any poisonous snake it's around. Oh, anyway. Bunch of snakes. This is why I'm sending you prophets, sages, and scribes. Some of them you will kill and crucify. Some of them you will flog in your synagogues and hound from town to town. So all the righteous blood shed on the earth will be charged to you. From the blood of righteous Abel to the blood of Zechariah, whom you murdered between the sanctuary and the altar, I assure you, all these things will come upon this generation. So, chapter 23, it's ending a little bit differently here. But the indictment against the religious leadership of the Jews is now pretty much complete. Jesus has been in the temple area. We have several chapters here where he has been speaking to them and about them. And when we get to 24, he's going to shift to his inner circle. He's going to talk to them about what's going to come. And we'll be looking at more details about that a little bit later. Here's where he concludes, though. He turns from the Pharisees and their indictment. He turns away from talking about their self-righteous hypocrisy. And he speaks to Jerusalem, about Jerusalem. Jerusalem, Jerusalem, she who kills the prophets and stones those who are sent to her. How often I wanted to gather your children together as a hen gathers her chicks under her wings. Yet you would not. You were not willing. See, your house is left to you desolate. For I tell you, you will never see me again until you say, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. That's the heart of Jesus. he's been rejected. We go all the way back to chapter 12, where the religious leaders just outright reject Jesus. And we've been dealing with that off and on up to this point. And what is his attitude? What is his desire? If this is Tuesday or Wednesday, he knows what's coming in a short period of time. 28 to 48 hours from now, he knows what's going to happen. And he looks at the city. Maybe at this time he's walked out and on the Mount of Olives, overlooking the city, making this statement. How often I would have gathered your children. I would gather you to myself. Just like a hen. Anybody raise chickens? Okay. Chickens, growing up especially, we had chickens, and she would set, and we'd put additional eggs under her. One time we put duck eggs under a chicken, but that's another story. Anyway, she'd sit there, and then after a certain time, I don't remember the amount of time now, but they would hatch. And, of course, the chickens, you know, they're ready to eat when they're born. There's bugs and anything else they can eat. But a hawk can fly over, and she made a certain clucking noise, and those little chicks would come running as hard as they could, and they'd go right under her wings. And after a while, they'd peek their heads out, see if it was, you know, safe to come out. And you'd see that. And she also would make a clucking noise, a little bit different clucking noise, and then that means she's found food. And then they come running as hard as they can. You know, first one there gets the bug, right? And so, you know, those kind of things. You get the imagery, and that you get that imagery that Jesus is using there. I've sent you the prophets. You've killed them. I've sent others to you, and you've ignored them, and you've mistreated them, and you drove them away. But I still would gather you to myself. And uses something very picturesque of what he means there. There's nothing harsh about that. And it's very stunning of how that picture plays into it. But what's happened? He's rejected. He's rejected. And the pieces are going to fall together real rapidly. Real rapidly. Okay. Comments or questions? We got 6 minutes.
Do you think any of these Pharisees saw the light and changed?
I think so. I don't know about these, but Pharisees did. I don't know how many, but there were a number. And that's where some of the conflict would later come in, is trying to understand how the gospel works. How so? Well, because they're carrying their Judaism right into it. And then, whoa, wait a minute, you know, wait a minute, so they still were very Jewish in their thinking, the feasts and all that kind of thing, trying to work out what does this gospel of grace mean. But yeah, they did. And, you know, like I said a few moments ago, the most notable example, of course, is Saul of Tarsus, who was a Pharisee of a Pharisee, trained by the most well-known of the Pharisees, Gamaliel, and he obviously believed. So yeah, some did. And like Nicodemus, for example, they all weren't harsh. The most of them were. But you remember that I began by reading you the list of the different kind of Pharisees? There were those God-fearing, humble men that were trying to live by faith and not by their self-righteousness. But so I have no idea how many, but there were some, to be sure. And they had to deal with a very, very, very thorny issue. And that thorny issue is the resurrection. Now, what do you do? What do you do now? And there were some that would be absolutely convinced that, yes, he is Messiah. You know, you probably you know, dead people don't normally come back alive. Not after what Jesus went through. It's just not going to happen. What happens when it does happen? Well, some just still double down. We got to get rid of them, you know, we got to stop this movement. Which is interesting, but another day. Any other questions or comments?
You heard people say that, well, like you talked earlier about, you know, if we could have been there and seen him with our eyes, you know, but like you said, how many people walked past him in the crowd and then that one woman touched his garment, you know, but how many other people brushed up against him and he said, who touched him?
Yeah.
You know, so it, you don't know how many people did.
Oh, yeah. And you know, it wasn't, he didn't do anything in secret, you know, really. So it was well known. A lot of witnesses. Even secular writers affirmed that these are the things that were said about him. Some would even call him some sort of magician because they had no other explanation, you know. So the miracles were indisputable. It's not today like, you know, you hear a tale of someone who received a miracle, and if you try to track them down, you'd never find them because it's some sort of story that had been circulated. But there are those that are legitimate. But even miracles don't convince everybody. It didn't convince fully Judas. He had other priorities. Chapter 24 is next. That's the one that most people, when they get into Matthew, that want to spend time in. It's the apocalyptic chapter. It's the one about future events. And it's one that's very difficult to interpret. Really it is. Jewish teachers had a methodology of taking a subject. You know, whatever the subject is, right? You know, X is the subject. You can't see on this side. That's not a very good X, but trust me. And instead of talking directly about what X is, they talk around it. That was just what they did. That's how they taught in many ways. Now, when you get to Paul, you know, talks about, you know, he has statements, prepositions, yeah, not prepositions. He postulates, you know, he's this, much more in key, you know, keeping in the way we think. This, you know, these, and it works well. When Jesus is teaching, he doesn't do that. You know, Paul is not living simply in Jerusalem all of his life. He's from another region, so he's learned other kinds of thing, other methodologies in thinking and whatnot, undoubtedly. But Jesus would speak like that. So sometimes it's like, okay, where are we going here? And you'll see that there are three questions that are asked. I believe there's three. If memory serves me right. There's three. And he doesn't answer A, B, and C. He answers A, and then C, and then back to B. And, you know, so we're going to try to negotiate those as best we can. But just be aware that it's not an easy task. And also understand something that may be surprising. Sometimes Jesus didn't speak the most plainly about a subject. He leaves it a little bit not crystal clear. And that's on purpose. We even find that, what, you know, in chapter 13. Why do you speak in parables? Well, those that think they're smart, I speak in parables to confuse them. Kind of what he says. And those that are humble will understand. So hopefully next time I see you, you will be humble.